health. Innovations and breakthroughs that seemed impossible years ago became closer in reality in 2025, and we talked with many of the policymakers and influencers at the forefront of these changes.
Last year, we learned a lot, and I think one of the, if I'm being honest with myself, one of the maybe appropriate criticisms of CHAI and the work that we did was that it was very technical and it was very detailed. We published a responsible AI guide that's 187 pages long. And so that can be a challenge if you're a small community health center looking to deploy AI in a responsible way. And so I think we've heard that criticism. I've taken that to heart. And so this year, we're going to be focusing on a major strategic effort, working with federally qualified health centers, community health centers across the nation to take the body of work that we've created over the past several years and develop playbooks that are much more accessible and usable to the lower resourced community centers, be them in rural Appalachia or, you know, inner city LA.
We also heard from the researchers who are unlocking the mysteries of everything from Parkinson's disease to substance use disorders.
The notion that we're seeing a significant decline in mortality from overdose.
Yes.
And that is very different from what we have been seeing for the past two decades, where everything is going up and up and up. Yep. And since 2023, we're starting to see it go down. How much down? 26% in 1 year. Yeah. So it is large and consequential. So that's very, very exciting.
And why? Why is it going down?
I think that the answer is multiple causes. It's not just one single one that is responsible for it. I would say that an important one has been a very aggressive campaign to distribute and make available the medications that we have to prevent people from overdosing, which are the medications for opioid use disorder. You treat people that are addicted to opioids with them, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare and our 2025 Rewind and Look Ahead program. You know, long COVID has been an important topic to many of our listeners, as well as to us. And in 2025, there were setbacks. The National Institute of Health canceled many of the grants under the Recovery Initiative, the main federal program studying long COVID biology. Yet over 400 million people, Margaret, worldwide, are still living with the effects of long COVID. New research showed that for older adults, the consequences may be profound and lasting. We interviewed a leading researcher about his global study of over 3,500 patients.
The importance will depend on whether what we have found generalizes. And what I mean by that is remains true over the long term. The data we have now overwhelmingly are from 1 or 1.5 years after the original infection, and we are now long past that the timeline. And what we need to figure out, and we're doing studies currently to address that question, is whether what we found in that initial set of samples is stable, meaning it remains the same, has gotten worse, or the impairment has become progressive, or has recovered to some extent. Mm-hmm. And that is really the crucial question. Most of the indications we have from follow-up data are that it is either the same or progressive. We don't see recovery in older adults. We do see significant recovery in folks under the age of 60, but not in people over the age of 60. So what this implies is that if, assuming it remains true, it implies that the likelihood of developing significant cognitive impairment, which is already a public health problem, as you might know, the rates of dementia in the older adult population in the United States and worldwide because of the aging of the population itself have increasingly become a public health concern and are only likely to increase over the next 10 or 15 years. This would imply, if it remained true as I suggested, that the magnitude of that crisis is at least two times greater, if not more.
We also spoke to the co-director of Northwestern Medicine's Comprehensive COVID-19 Center. Dr. Igor Koralnik explained how they're investigating potential causes.
Different etiologies have been entertained for the root cause of long COVID, and they're not mutually exclusive. They may, you know, be together at the same time. So viral persistence is one. The virus remains hidden or dormant in some places in the body and needs to be treated with antiviral medication. The treatment of Paxlovid, at least in these two smaller studies for 14 to 20 days, was not efficient. We will wait for the result of this larger study that is now, we enrolled patients at Northwestern in many sites in the country, and we will wait for the result of this study. That's one thing. Another is autoimmunity. The virus comes and confuses the immune system that there's something abnormal in the body that needs to be attacked. We see that in our clinic and in every post-COVID clinic, actually, there is a predominance of women. So two-thirds of the patients are women, and we know that women are more likely than men to develop other autoimmune disease like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and so on. And we see also an enrichment in the patient population of people who had prior autoimmune disease before COVID-19. So there probably is an autoimmune predisposition. We are working on this in my lab. Other labs are also looking at it. So far, there is no medication or immunomodulatory medication that has come out of this research, which is still ongoing. Third possibility is that long COVID is caused by a microvascular disease. And you know that the spike protein of the virus can bind the ACE2 receptor on the surface of endothelial cells, for example, lining the blood vessel, and can trigger some inflammation or even infection of these cells. And we have published recently a study looking at the microvascular structure of the retina in the back of the eye using a ophthalmological technique called optical coherence tomography angiography with a lead ophthalmologist here at Northwestern, Dr. Manjot Gill. And we have seen a decrease in the caliber of very small vessel in the retina in patients with neurologic complication of COVID-19. And so it is possible that this decreased perfusion that we see in the eye is actually a window on the brain and other organs and could cause some of the symptomatology that the patients have.
Of course, healthcare affects us all at an individual level. One of the biggest names dealing with health challenge is Michael J. Fox. Over 25 years ago, he announced he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Since then, he's devoted his talents to eliminating Parkinson's in our lifetime. Samantha Hutton is a neuroscientist and vice president of the translational research at the Michael J. Fox Foundation. She shared details about their Parkinson progression marker initiative.
And the idea here is that if we can detect Parkinson's earlier, we can treat it sooner. Hopefully, one day we can prevent the disease altogether. So in the 15 years since PPMI started, it's really become the cornerstone of PD research. We have over 3,400 participants to date in PPMI. This is continuing to grow. It's very impressive. These are participants who come to around 50 clinical sites around the world. These are newly diagnosed individuals, those who have a family connection to Parkinson's disease, people with risk factors for potentially developing Parkinson's, like loss of sense of smell or sleep disorders, as well as healthy volunteers. And today, PPMI is still going strong. So there are some folks who have been in the study for 15 years now. They come in for regular visits to participate in clinical testing, brain scans. They donate their biosamples like blood and spinal fluid. And this is the cornerstone of the new biomarker breakthrough that you mentioned, which is now able to detect pathology associated with Parkinson's disease in living people. So As I mentioned, biomarkers tell us things about diseases. For other diseases like cholesterol or heart disease, we have things that can reliably detect the pathology and then tell us with 100% certainty whether somebody has a disease or doesn't. So things like A1C for diabetes, cholesterol levels for heart disease, pregnancy tests. We haven't had that for Parkinson's disease until now, which is why this breakthrough is so exciting. So I can tell you a little bit about the biomarker, which is called the alpha-synuclein seed amplification assay, or alpha-synuclein SAA for short. It's a very long name. But you probably know alpha-synuclein is a protein that accumulates in the brains of everybody with Parkinson's disease. It's the pathological hallmark of the disease. And to date, it's been very difficult to measure this in living people, especially the aggregated or clumped up form that occurs in the brains of people with Parkinson's. So we've funded work on this biomarker over the last 10 years. It's essentially a very novel way to measure the clumped up alpha-synuclein in a person's spinal fluid. So somebody comes in and they donate their spinal fluid, and then we can measure this pathological alpha-synuclein using a test that actually turns out to be over 90% accurate for diagnosing people with Parkinson's disease. And the really, really cool thing about this test is that it doesn't only detect alpha-synuclein, pathological alpha-synuclein in people with Parkinson's disease, but it's actually quite accurate in being able to identify people who later go on to develop Parkinson's disease even before they have manifest symptoms. So that's the test in a nutshell. And we're really excited to have been part of this advancement in biomarker research.
Former Republican member of the U.S. House, Mary Bono from California, is another high-profile name who's taken on a health advocacy role. She explained how her late husband, Sonny Bono, and her son both struggled with substance use issues, and that motivates her today in her role as the co-founder and the honorary chair of Mothers Against Prescription Drug Abuse.
This is very personal, and I have been affected by substance abuse disorders in my family, you know, my whole life. And that runs on both sides and through marriages and all sorts of stuff. And the important thing here is, it can happen to anybody. I was a sitting member of Congress when it happened in my family, which is pretty mind-blowing when you think about it, that here she's crusading on this, and then here it is happening in my own family. So I used to say when I was in Congress, there are things that you are and things that you do. Mm-hmm. And this one for me was deeply personal and obviously preventable. So I did champion it and talk about it. And you know, my campaign chairman, when I first ran for Congress and throughout my 15 years, originally was President Ford. And then when he passed, Betty Ford became my campaign chair. Mm. And she was always a beacon of hope for me on these issues of removing stigma from people who have a substance use disorder. And, you know, getting treatment is okay. So yeah, I thought talking about it publicly was important for a couple of reasons. Number one, if this happened to my family, it can happen to yours. And then number two, to say there's nothing wrong with asking for help when you're ready and when you need it. So it's, again, great mentor leadership in Mrs. Ford.
Absolutely.
It's a great role model for me. Yeah.
In terms of addiction issues, one of the most exciting conversations in 2025 was with the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Dr. Nora Volkoff. Predicted how close we are to curing addiction when we spoke to her at Aspen Ideas Health.
We have been funding research, as I mentioned, more than a decade ago in animal models. It stops them from drug taking, these GLP drugs. But there's also two randomized clinical trials in alcohol showing that people stop drinking, reduce their drinking behavior. We've been funding also studies for tobacco. Is reducing tobacco. The data, the clinical trials were not as large. So, and we're doing studies with opioid addiction, and we're doing studies with cannabis, and we're doing studies with cocaine and methamphetamine. It looks very promising. And so that is another aspect in terms of developing medications that right now, and I don't think I ever been as excited about the opportunities that we have. We have the GLPs, which also have already been given to humans. So if they show to be effective, we could bring them into the market relatively rapidly. But the other one are psychedelics. I mean, I was speaking about the issue of neuroplasticity. Right. So the whole concept is, are there drugs that we can use to open up those neuroplastic windows so that our brain changes faster? And we can do those changes within a context that you can do, for example, a cognitive intervention, or you can use neuromodulation, which is another aspect of technologies and tools that is very, very exciting and promising. So through it, you can fine tune certain circuits and linkages that may be disrupted by addiction, for example, or strengthen those that you know are necessary for you to improve your ability to self-regulate desires and emotions. So if you think, and that's what I was trying to say with a big idea, combining these different elements and tools that we have. Mm-hmm. So that's where I can see the future into addiction. And that's why I say I would have never, ever in my life there to say we're going to cure addiction. Yeah. I think that we now have knowledge and tools that could potentially, definitively lead us to a cure of addiction.
Well, Mark, the future is indeed exciting. We talked to Dr. Robert Pearl, who co-authored the book ChatGPT-MD with the help of generative AI. He says the tech's strength lies in its access to the entirety of medical knowledge.
First of all, I want to tell viewers and listeners that All Profits Go to Doctors Without Borders, a great charity, has had the profits from all my previous books. I wrote it because, as you know, November 30th, 2022, the generative AI, ChatGPT, was released. Now, I named it ChatGPT-MD, my book title, because it flows so beautifully. But everything I'm about to say about ChatGPT is just as true about Gemini from Google, just as true as Claude from Anthropic, and the most recently released Chinese DeepSeek model. But what I realized is that this is an exponential technology. In that way, it's very different than something like the electronic health record. An exponential technology, actually like a coronavirus, doubles every year. And in this situation, the technology, ChatGPT, would be 32 times more powerful in 5 years. And in fact, if I went through the typical cycles I had with my previous books of going through a traditional publisher and writing it on my own, it would have taken about 2 years. By that time, the technology is four times as powerful and everything I write would be outdated. So I said, how do I increase the speed, accelerate the writing and distribution process? And I decided that the way to do it, and by the way, an interesting way to do it would be to work with ChatGPT so that I could firsthand experience this generative AI tool, not just in clinical practice, but also in the creation of artistic work. And I approach it the same way I do with a resident or a medical student with whom I'm writing a paper. In this situation, I gave ChatGPT the 1.2 million words that I had written and published. I would normally give a bunch of articles to a medical student or resident. And then we exchanged drafts back and forth, probably 30 different drafts per chapter. There are 6 pages in there, I should point out, that were written only by ChatGPT or mainly by ChatGPT. And I highlight those so readers can see how the technology itself would work. But all the others were, I'll call it a collaborative effort, and represents a combination of the voices that were there.
Margaret, of course, 2025 will also be known as the year where no interview didn't have a question about AI. So that was very fascinating to hear from him. Tech advancements also require rules and regulations. We heard from Dr. Brian Anderson, the CEO of the Coalition for Health AI, about how his organization is working to establish clear guidelines for responsible AI in healthcare.
Let me start with one of the kind of the very basic principles in responsible AI, which is transparency. The example or metaphor I like to use is when you and I go to a grocery store and we, you know, look to buy a can of soup and we want to know what's in it, we turn around the can of soup, we look behind and we see the nutrition label and we know, you know, how many carbohydrates, how much protein, how much fat is in it, what the ingredients are. We have that kind of understanding because we have an expectation of the transparency that we get to know about the things that we're going to be buying at a grocery store. One of the challenges in AI, and in particular in responsible AI, is a common agreement on the level of transparency for the customers of AI in partnership with vendors to understand how these models are built. What kind of data sets were the models trained on? As a physician myself, I might be very concerned about knowing if a model was trained on a particular kind of patient that I might have in front of me? Was it trained on this kind of patient? Is it appropriate for the patient that I have in front of me? Not having that kind of transparency, not having that assurance that these models are trained on the kinds of people that I, as a physician or a nurse, might be serving, is a real challenge to building the kind of trust. And so when we did this work, we brought together the vendor community, so big tech companies and small startups, as well as their customers, namely health systems and payers and health plans, and said, okay, what is the minimum threshold of transparency from a responsible AI standpoint that the vendors and their customers can agree to in what we've now called an AI nutrition label or our model card, that is that base level of answering questions like, what's in it? What are the data sets used? What are the indications? What are the limitations of using these kinds of model? And so it's that kind of hard work building to a technical level of specificity. So getting from the 50,000 foot, you know, we all want transparency, we all want safety, but what does it actually look like? And so that's the work that we've been focused on. That's some of the examples in the Assurance Standards Guide.
Mark, one of our most inspiring conversations in 2025 was with the man known as the father of aerobics, Dr. Kenneth Cooper.
Loved him.
Joined us at age 94, Dr. Cooper remains a passionate advocate for reshaping our national approach to health, particularly through the lens of prevention. A theme at the center of his book, Grow Healthier As You Grow Older, relevant for all of us.
And he will be back on his 100th birthday, I'm sure.
We hope so.
With as much vim and vigor.
Let me tell you what happened, because if it had been half my life, I wouldn't even be here today, because in high school, I was an athlete. I made All-State basketball, won the state championship in a mile. I got a scholarship to University of Oklahoma. I weighed 168 pounds during my athletic career. But then I got into medical school, and I discovered that obesity is the most common manifestation of stress. So I started gaining weight just to keep awake at night. My internship made it worse. By the time I finished my internship, I'd gone from 168 to 204. I weighed that much. And then for 6 years, I was waiting in the Army. I was deferred for the draft. So for years, 6 years, I didn't realize back in those days that exercise had a health factor. Exercise was just competition as far as I knew about. And so in my obese state, 29 years of age, I went water skiing. At that time, too, I was hypertense and I had pre-diabetic condition just because of my obesity. Halfway through the skiing up here at Lake Texoma, I got hit with chest pain and my heart started racing out of my chest. So they got me over the side. I'm still in the Air Force. My heart rate came back to normal. And so they got me the next day about a school of aerospace medicine for a complete examination. And they said, Doc, only thing wrong with you, you're out of shape. And here I'd gone up at 29 years of age, I was overweight and active, but all the things that I mentioned, all that. And so I changed my lifestyle. I planned becoming an ophthalmologist after I finished my internship. But when I lost the weight within 6 months from my first marathon, I ran the Boston Marathon twice and 30,000 miles in 40 years, all that disappeared. I thought this is a field of medicine, but sadly not. So I changed my direction. That was an epiphany from God, as far as I'm concerned, that made me change my direction from becoming an ophthalmologist, become a specialist in preventive medicine when I was advised to not against it. And look what happened. We have a full-time, we have 31 physicians on our staff. We have eight different subspecialties here, and we have people we can't even handle, people waiting in lines.
Dr. Cooper gives us great motivation for tackling our New Year's resolution. We look forward to more guests in 2026, like Dr. Cooper, who are influencing how we think about our healthcare system and the ideas and policy that fuel how it works.
So just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com and sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about the program with us. Happy holidays. Happy New Year, everybody.
And Margaret, just a special shout out to our overseer who really keeps all of this of us going, Adam Shapiro, Leslie Gianelli, and in our studio, CJ and Dan, thank you all. They made
absolutely
made us look much better.
Happy New Year. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.